Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I have the exciting Part 2 episode with UC Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott on the deep state and the clash of the mainstream media and CIA with the Trump administration and the alternative media. Now, the media has been on a disinformation campaign to discredit and minimize the impact of Professor Scott's term, the deep state, which he coined long before the media decided it didn't exist. In this special episode, we'll expose the efforts of the deep state to influence the national dialogue, to create the conditions for a new Cold War with Russia to satisfy the financial interests behind the war machine. Are we witnessing a war between the deep state and the presidency? Let's go ask Professor Peter Dale Scott.
This is wide angle stuff. We do know that people are beginning to talk for the first time about the deep state, and I believe they should.
The Dark Journalist's Deep State Battle Special Report. Trump versus the Deep State, the CIA and Cold War II. Featuring an in-depth two-part interview with American Deep State author Professor Peter Dale Scott. Now, let's join Dark Journalist Daniel List.
Professor Scott, it's great to have you back for part two of our deep discussion on the deep state. Now, we have a lot of issues to cover, including this big push that we're seeing for Cold War II and vilifying Putin, the media attack on the independent media, calling them fake news, calling anyone basically who isn't them fake news, and the battle between the CIA and the Trump presidency.
Right.
Now, since we defined the deep state in part one, I'd like to start off by asking you what we know for sure about this crucial period of time that we're in now. And also, what do we know about the deep state and the efforts of this covert system to derail and to really take down the presidency of Donald Trump?
Well, we do know we're living in an interesting time. We do know that people are beginning to talk for the first time about the deep state, and I believe they should. And we should not take sides. I think it'd be wrong to believe with David Ignatius that the deep state is merely enforcing the rule of law when they're breaking the law in their enforcement. I think Breitbart has a very good point there. And I think most people watching this show probably can think of things that Trump wants to do that they oppose. But when Trump wants to avoid a cold war with Russia, I would think any sane person would want that, because the risks of a renewed cold war are very high. We are extremely lucky that we got through the last cold war without any nuclear weapons being used. It was partly great restraint, good political leadership on both sides, and a great deal of it, I'm afraid, was just luck. Because more than once, there was an order given to respond to a nuclear attack with a nuclear response, and the nuclear attack was a phantom. It was not there. It was on the field. And there is, the major case was that there's some Soviet citizen, low level, who said, "I'm not going to push the button until I get better proof." And there was no proof, because it wasn't an event. And that man saved us from World War III, which would have destroyed all of us. You and I would not be having this show if not for that Soviet citizen.
Well, it's an excellent point, and it definitely takes cooler heads on the ground prevailing. That's really what makes a difference. Now, as we see this incredible push going on for a new Cold War II, it's embedded in the media, this kind of anti-Russian mindset, and they're not really even giving good reasons for it. You know, they're pushing it, and they're attacking President Trump and his administration with this Russian hysteria by claiming falsely that he's some kind of Putin puppet. Just ridiculous. But unfortunately, this is what has become of the Democratic Party, infiltrated by the neocons to a point where we have to expect them to be leading the war drums, no longer neocon Republicans. So I guess my question is, what are some of the real dangers of this partnership that's going on now between the deep state and the mainstream media?
What is very visible and very alarming, I think of all the things to be scared about now, the most alarming thing is the PAC journalism attack on Putin. I don't want to defend Putin particularly, but I don't want to see a heating up of the Cold War, which we began to see under Obama. And by the way, a lot of it has to do with the demise from old age of an old generation of nuclear weapons. And the big bucks job for the military-industrial complex to give us a new nuclear thing. And so, is it $1 trillion that has been dedicated to this under Obama?
Yes, $1 trillion is the price tag for the renewal of our nuclear weapons systems, yes.
But why are we going to renew all the nuclear weapons if we don't have a nuclear enemy? So, no, we need a nuclear enemy.
Uh-huh.
And why are we having all this anti-Putin propaganda? Well, there are a number of reasons, but one of them is the old-fashioned military-industrial complex, which is a not negligible part of the deep state.
Right.
And we had in the 50s and the early 60s, people don't remember now, the missile gap. America was a terrible risk, and that was the days when school children were being told to put their heads under the school desks.
Yeah.
They wouldn't get nuclear fallout. I mean, such absurd things have happened in this country in the name of major policy pushes.
Right. Now, I want to touch on this point of the deep state and its real meaning that you brought to it, versus what the media is trying to paint it as, you know, basically as a conspiracy that doesn't exist. Of course, your work on this topic covers the better part of 40 years. Now, what's a key difference between how you've defined the deep state and what the media publicizes about it? You know, right now they're running around saying that this author, Mike Lofgren, created the term in his book in 2015. We know that's false. And I don't care if it's in Wikipedia. Of course, that's more fake Wikipedia for you. No surprises there. But how do you define it? And how do you see, how do you feel about this other book that the media is putting out there to really deflect away from some of the really deep research that you've done?
The deep state involves both big money and organized crime. And my competing book that is careful to say he's not talking about conspiracies, that's Mike Lofgren and his book, The Deep State. And because he says he's not about conservative, his is a mainstream book and gets reviews, and it sells very well. It's publicized. My book does get into conspiracies and is only for very nutty people who are interested for some crazy reason in conspiracy theories. But even Mike Lofgren, though he's not going to get into conspiracy theories, he takes a definition from Derin Devlet, the Turkish version, and there in his book he recognizes the deep state involves organized crime. That is the only time in his book that he mentions organized crime. He mentions that as part of the definition that comes out of Turkey. If you want to enjoy yourself, read how he talks about 9/11. Because you cannot talk about the deep state without mentioning 9/11, the worst features of it, the warrantless surveillance, the warrantless detention. We have warrantless detention. We in this country, after 10 years of Project Endgame, they finally produce an army handbook that is thick, which you can get online, about their program for retention, which is, I would say, detention. We do have an army-backed plan to round up large numbers of people. If you ever get an Occupy movement that doesn't make all the silly mistakes that the Occupy movement made.
Now, I know that someone listening who's very interested in your work and in what happened with the Occupy movement would be interested to hear exactly what you think their mistakes were.
I summarize them in... I think I have the right book. Yes. No, it's the wrong book. Excuse me. Anyway, the American Deep
State. American Deep State, right? That's the one.
American Deep State ends
Right. At the end of the American Deep State, there is a great analysis of what went wrong with the Occupy movement. One of the other chapters in the book that I really think is fantastic is on the Doomsday Project and how COG, a continuity of government planning, really subordinated the U.S. Constitution. Now, we did some coverage in part one on COG, and we've done an episode on it with you previous to that. But in short, originally COG, this doomsday planning, was meant to provide for a government if the president and the vice president and the leadership were decapitated in a nuclear strike. Now, they brought this planning to a whole new level and purpose in the 1980s under Reagan and Bush, and eventually it was used on September 11th, 2001, in response to the attacks on that day. Now, they did institute a state of emergency on September 14th, 2001, and we're still living under that today in this country.
They had Oliver North, who was planning all of this with Rumsfeld and Cheney. Mm-hmm. And his motive for planning was, he said, we didn't lose the Vietnam War in Vietnam. No, sir, we lost it right here in the streets of this city. And that was the motivation for the COG planning. It wasn't to deal with a decapitated government. It was to deal with a government being resisted by people below who didn't want to fight wars in the rest of the world. And it's going to be a tough fight. I think we will still, maybe under this presidency, we will see it, because we have a president now who himself says he doesn't want to see America involved in so many wars. And I applaud that. It would be good for America not to be involved in so many wars. It's leading to the disparity of wealth. It's contributing to some of our key problems of poverty, et cetera, in this country.
Well, maybe that's why the CIA is resisting him so much, you know, because he's not into military adventurism and all of their plans depend on it. But he's not going to go there.
It's possible. We don't know.
Right. We don't know for certain how this foreign policy is going to shape up over the course of the near future here. But one of the aspects in pushing for Cold War II with Russia, you know, is certainly the fact that Russia has outlawed GMOs and is attempting to opt out of the central banking model. So they're kind of throwing a monkey wrench in part of this globalist vision. Now, those in the CIA and aspects in the political and media structures here, what exactly are they trying to accuse Putin of that jeopardizes anything that has an interest for us here in America?
That he expanded into the eastern Ukraine. Nobody's accused him of doing anything in the western Ukraine, in the eastern Ukraine. Well, on the other hand, America has been accused of doing things in the Ukraine, period. Well, both Russia and America put money behind candidates. We had something called, was it the Orange Revolution back in 2005? George Soros, I think, you know, some people hate George Soros, and a lot of Trump people really hate George Soros. I'm ambivalent about George Soros. I think he's throwing his money around too much. I think he genuinely wants open societies in various places. And I can imagine a lot of things he could do that would be good. But, you know, I spent 3 years in Thailand, and then I saw what George Soros, his people, I don't think it's Soros himself, but George Soros' people were doing in Thailand. And I think they don't have a clue about how Thailand works. And I would advise them to just stay out of Thailand. You don't understand Thailand. I was only there 3 years, and I understand it well enough to think that you were doing more harm than good by what you did. And they didn't do very much.
Right.
But all this foreign money in Ukraine has not been good for Ukraine. It gave us a possibly good government, but it also gave us a Russian reaction to it. They say, oh, America's going to do that. We're going to do it too, and we got, what was his name, called Yevtushenko, but that's not right, Yanukovych.
Right, Yanukovych.
And then we had the Maidan, which threw him out, and that eventually, that looked like people power, you know, it looked like, and it, at the beginning, it probably was very clean and beautiful, but it got uglier and uglier. And in the end, there were sharpshooters in the Maidan, picking people off.
Wow.
And we got a revival of a very sinister element, Ukrainian politics, which are those hyper-nationalists who first of all collaborated with the Nazis when the Nazis came in, and they killed a number of Jews, and they killed a number of Poles. The estimates are about 70,000 Jews and at least as many Poles. These are not, well, the people who did the shooting are now dead, mostly.
Right.
But the people who want to make heroes out of the shooters are still there. And they
right, these are neo-Nazi elements that exist there.
And they were there in the Maidan, and they may have been in a key factor in throwing out the president whose name began with Y, who was, by the way, very corrupt. Then we saw pictures of palace and everything. No, he was very corrupt. In the Ukraine, corruption rules.
Yes.
That's just the way it is.
Right. And just to give some context for this, the president of the Ukraine you mentioned there is Viktor Yanukovych. Now, he's in exile in Russia now, and he still considers himself the legitimate president of the Ukraine. Now, as you said, the protesters in Maidan in Independence Square, they forced him out. But since he was seen as under the influence of Russia, the protests were largely supported, you know, to bring out this pro-European Union whole power structure. And there definitely is manipulation on both sides, in other words. So this other neo-Nazi element that also rose and took part in the uprising found its way into some government position. And I think this shows how intelligence agencies don't mind utilizing these kind of fascist elements. Of course, we go all the way back to World War II and the aftermath there. Well, we integrated some of that Nazi intelligence apparatus, and that's what became kind of the basis of the European version of our CIA. So we really have to see this aspect of the deep state operating and how their operations go down. Now, since we're discussing Yanukovych, we should mention that there are attempts to link in a sinister fashion former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, who Trump fired, let's remember, and who also worked with previous Republican candidates, McCain, the neocon, and Mitt Romney, with Yanukovych. Now, Manafort did work for him, right?
Beyond a shadow of a doubt, worked for the man whose name begins with Y. It's not
okay.
And that was a force backed also by Putin. So that was a supposed. What the question is, how much of that is a link with Putin or with Russia, as opposed to just a link with Y?
Okay, and Manafort is a complex political operator. There's no question. He was part of Black, Manafort, Stone, and Kelly, which was a major lobbying firm back in the 80s and 90s. And the Black is Charles Black Jr., who worked for both Bushes. And Stone is Roger Stone, that kind of Republican hitman in a political sense. He's worked with all the way back to Nixon, worked with Reagan, and recently he did some work for Trump in 2016. He also authored some books on Clinton and Bush corruption. Now let's go for a moment to the core of what you see they're trying to hang on Trump in regards to Russia, so far with no evidence, but lots of innuendo and speculation. But even if it's to just examine the way the deep state tries to destroy someone, let's look at this narrative for a moment. And most of this was spread, of course, by CNN and BuzzFeed, which I consider the lowest of the low. I don't think there's anything worse. But let's follow the deep state Trump-Russia narrative.
There was an intelligence report prepared by a private detective in England called Christopher Steele that eventually people leaked bits of it from time to time, and eventually the whole report came out in BuzzFeed and then became the subject of news stories.
Right.
And we don't know if those stories are true or false, but they're sensational. They started at the very beginning, and I think it's almost a Baudelaire version, that Trump was in Moscow and hired prostitutes to do what? Well, not to do what you normally hire prostitutes for. According to the report, he hired them to pee on the bed that Obama had slept in.
Right.
The report does not say whether Trump himself was in the bed or on the sidelines watching. That would be a relevant fact in the story that we certainly don't. We don't know any of this. It's not established. It goes to source A and source D.
Yeah.
Apparently some of the details in about Trump's sex activities were established by a billionaire called Aras Agalarov. Not being a subject of many stories recently, although, you know, if Trump was involved in sexual activities in Moscow, that is a subject of legitimate concern for the CIA, because the Russians are very big on what they call kompromat. They like to get pictures of people having sex. That's one of the ways that Russian politics is conducted.
I see.
I had a friend, somebody more my kind of guy, who was exposing things about the deep state, and to his great surprise, he got invited to Moscow. And to his great surprise, he came back and he reported to me proudly. He said, you know, Russia is a very different kind of country. I came back to my hotel room, and there was a naked woman in there. I had the greatest night of my life. He didn't seem very worried about compromat.
Uh-huh.
Not going to name the person, but he got into major problems after that. It's a sad story, and if I told you the details, you might guess who it was, and so we're not going there.
Oh, that's all right.
So I'm just going to say, as a fact, if Trump had any kind of sex in a Russian hotel, whether it involved golden showers or not, the Russians would have a tape of it, and that would be a matter of legitimate concern to the CIA. But all of this is speculative.
Absolutely. And as I said, that's taking a page right out of our own CIA handbook. That kind of blackmail, presuming it's a fabrication, it shows about the level that some of these people think on. Very destructive stuff. Now, the story was never corroborated, as we pointed out here. It's completely unsubstantiated. But the sheer rumor fed the news cycles, and it put the media, especially BuzzFeed, CNN, Washington Post, at an all-new low for reporting standards. So this element of the deep state has really worked closely with the media to get these damaging stories out. Now the next question is why? Why do they so badly want to destroy President Trump? And this goes way beyond partisanship, as we've shown. We've laid out the Cold War II scenario. You know, the war machine stands to lose a lot of money, a lot of clout. And by the way, Trump proposes a major military budget. Apparently, it's not big enough for them. So let's look at another reason, that there is a war in the deep state. Now, you've said before the deep state is not a structure, like the CIA, for example, but it's more like a system.
A system, a process. It's always changing. It's very different now from what it was in the 60s. And one of the things is that this marginal element, the 11 men of the John Birch Society in a closed room, The real minority losers in the 50s, it grew and grew and grew and grew until it may or may not be. It's certainly a competing factor in the deep state now, and very well organized and extremely well funded.
Well, I am fascinated by the split in the deep state, and we know when the CIA and the presidency are at such odds with each other, that there's a lot of action going on behind the scenes. Now, clearly, with Trump running an America First campaign, you know, make America great again, rejecting NAFTA, rejecting globalism, the TPP, these trade deals that really cored out the manufacturing base of the United States and our ability to employ our own people, the battle lines were drawn right there. So my question is, what aspect of the deep state supports this populist rhetoric and the policies that really put America first?
There's always been an American First faction in American politics. It was very big in the 30s. It was represented by President, he never was president, by Taft.
Robert Taft.
in the Republican Party, and it was attacked by the internationalist Republicans, represented really, I think, best by Nelson Rockefeller. And that's why the Halloween massacre in 75 was so important, because in dismissing Rockefeller, that was the end of the domination of the Republican Party by the internationalist wing. The what you might call the Council on Foreign Relations. You know, David had been the president of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Right, right.
Versus the National Association of Manufacturers, who weren't as interested in international banking and all that sort of, were the productive Rust Belt people. And their first main political effort was, after the war, was the John Birch Society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I once read a book about John Birch Society describing it as a populist movement. It's not a populist movement if it's founded by 12 people in a room and 11 of them have been senior people in the National Association of Manufacturers. One of those people, by the way, was a man called Fred Koch, who was not very, no one took him very seriously then, but he was the head of Koch Industries, and he was succeeded there by his sons, two of whom, David Koch and, is it Charles Koch?
Yes, Charles. They're the Koch brothers.
The Koch brothers have been one of the huge forces behind the change in American politics. They've been very important for one reason only. They have so much money, and their money is at stake in policies. And they can put $1 billion into American politics and get it back and more if Trump can change the tax rules away, because there's a whole lot of tax rules that are about to be repealed.
Uh-huh.
And now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that the Kochs backed Trump. They were very careful not to back Trump, and Trump was very careful not to say nice things about the Kochs. And instead, he appointed, he appointed people in his campaign who were very close to another billionaire called Robert Mercer, who, again, most people haven't heard about.
He works with super PACs.
People who are real forces in American politics, because American politics is run by money more than ever before, especially since the Citizens United case. And this is the real root problem that's not going to go away soon. Anyway, Trump was being opposed by elements of the deep state. He was also being backed by elements of the deep state. And he was particularly being backed, the money in his campaign, so much of it was money of the kind that Jane Mayer wrote about in an excellent book called Dark Money. If you want to understand what's going on now, read that book. And she talks about people who have, they're not the heads of publicly owned corporations, you know, with stock and so on. They're the heads of corporations that are owned by themselves or by their families. And they can do, you know, there's rules on what publicly owned corporations can do, but there are far less rules for these people. And a high percentage of these people are people who have actually had some trouble with government regulations, have been investigated. We'll take one case, Betsy DeVos.
Uh-huh.
Her father owned Amway Corporation, which is very close to being a Ponzi scheme. This is where salesmen go out and sell products, but what they're really doing is selling more salesmanships. And, you know, the first person who sells the salesmanships makes a lot of money. But sooner or later, there's no more people to sell the salesmanships to. And so the last people in lose money, they don't make money.
Uh-huh.
This was investigated both in Canada and in America. I hope I don't get sued for this, but I believe that Amway Corporation settled and paid $22 million in fines. So they have trouble with regulations, and they would prefer a government that promises not to regulate, and that's essentially what Trump promises. And to boot, Betsy DeVos is now the Secretary of Education. And I think she's going to begin to get a bit of education about education. Maybe she'll be a good secretary. I don't know. Maybe all these agencies need a bit of shaking up.
Let's
see what happens. Maybe some bad will come out of it and some good will come out of it. So certainly everybody, I think, agrees that education is it has deep, deep problems now. And we're searching around for solutions. My own grandchildren were home educated. That's one solution. They got, I think, a very good education. And three of my grandchildren are wonderful, and they're all home educated, and they're all great advertisements for home educated. Very talented, very creative.
Well, homeschooling continues to improve, and it's a long tradition here in America. Of course, the major scandal and controversy in education these days is Common Core, this very authoritarian, kind of software-driven, robotic, centralized version of education is being forced on cities and towns. And I've spoken to many teachers about it who are really against it.
I was very against Common Core, yes. And that was something put in by the Department of Education. So I am also ambivalent about the Department of Education. But I'm also ambivalent about the idea that you give it all back to the states and that Mississippi can do what it likes and California can do what it likes.
Well, Professor, you have a great vantage point to observe American society as a deep state author, a former Canadian diplomat, a historian, and a professor. There at the University of California, Berkeley. How do you feel about some of the divisions that we see happening now in America?
It's all very sad. America is a wonderful society that has, from the very beginning, been deeply divided and, in addition, has had problems with government because we have a closely regulated government because of the Constitution. And that means that there's a lot of power outside in the country, but not in the Constitution. That's roughly what I would mean by the deep state, is all that excess power. We didn't set up in 1787 a constitution to deal with corporations because we barely had corporations
back. Right.
We got our corporations in the 19th century. If we could have a constitution to regulate them, then we would have a more evenly balance of power in this country, which would, I think, take care of many of the problems. But that's a poet in me speaking. I'm not saying we're going to campaign for that. We're going to campaign, and I am very serious about this, get rid of the state of emergency. Expose and regulate the continuity of government regulations, which are so secret that even the House Committee on Intelligence, or was it House Committee on Government Operations, wasn't allowed to see them and was told that the rules of COG forbade the House Committee from seeing the rules on COG. So that is a sign, if you need it. That happened back in 2007. And then they gave up trying. But that's a symptom that the deep state is running the state, and the state should be regulating the deep state. And we need, that's something to aim at, a huge, huge story that I talk about in this book. And I've talked about my last three books, actually.
So you're talking about American War Machine and The Road to 9/11. And we could say, really, that these are a set.
Well, I talked about even before drugs, war, and politics was a first attempt. No, depolling the death of JFK.
Yes.
Was the beginning of the series. All of them have something to say that's useful. And, you know, I usually unlike today, I usually don't mention or say very much about the Kennedy assassination, because that turns off a huge audience and guarantees that I will not be reported in certain news outlets. Mm-hmm. That's why, that's an example of the Kennedy assassination, the other deep events, not going to get talked about in the U.S. media, will be talked about in the French media. I have a much closer relationship to the mainstream media in France. Not huge, but much bigger than here.
You know, that's fascinating. And I think it says a lot about the failing of our media here, which is that not only do they have the failure to consider ideas that are outside of their information comfort zone, but deep political research, you know, if it doesn't fit their agenda, they're just going to go this other way. And I find that absurd. Of course, I know that your books achieve much more notoriety in other countries. We were talking earlier about Australia.
Canberra Times, which is a mainstream media in Australia's capital, they have an article about the deep state that mentions me and mentions deep events.
Wow.
That's very unusual for me.
No question. Well, I'm often explaining to people that, in my opinion, and I really want to go on the record with this, over 80% of solid alternative media journalism, including mine, uses your research, credited or uncredited. And when the media was going to appropriate and minimize your deep state theme, I said, we're really going to tell everyone about the amazing and influential work that you've done. And when we come back, we're going to go deeper, this time into the synchronicity of deep events. Last round of part two here. Professor Peter Dale Scott, stay with us.
Dark Journalist subscribers renew early and save. For a limited time, you can go to darkjournalist.com/renew and renew your subscription at the discount rate of just $39 for one full year. Lock in last year's discount for a savings of $30 and get the shows you want to hear at this special discount. Don't miss out. Renew early and save by going to darkjournalist.com/renew or use the renew link on the member page. See you there.
And we are back. This is Dark Journalist, and I'm speaking with Professor Peter Dale Scott. Professor Scott's latest book, The American Deep State, will be out as a paperback in May at Barnes & Noble and other booksellers. The hardcover edition seems to be all but sold out, so good going. Professor Scott coined the deep state term to refer to a hidden system of political power that entails a strange combination of organized crime, big money, intelligence agencies, and they're at the very heart of activities like drug running, money laundering, arms dealing, and influence peddling. Now, I've been reading Professor Scott for years, but every time he puts out a new book, I always am blown away by the new things that he's uncovered in the deep state. Now, Professor, one thing you've identified that I find very compelling is the strange overlap or pattern of similarities between deep events like the JFK assassination and the events of 9/11, which may give us all some idea of what is at the heart of these incidents. And even though in this case, they're actually separated by 40 years. Now, one of these patterns, the unusual movements of certain stocks that give us some idea that someone had foreknowledge that these events were about to occur. So one of your examples involves D.H. Byrd.
Yes.
And one of his investments prior to the JFK assassination. Can you tell us about it?
It's more than one stock movement, not the biggest stock movement by any means, but there was in the early November 63, which is to say the weeks immediately before the assassination, there's a company called Alpha Omega starts buying stock in one of the aircraft manufacturers, Texas-based, called Ling Temco Vought. And this was actually an insider purchase, because the two people purchasing were James Ling, the principal owner of LTV, Ling Chemical Vout, and D.H. Byrd, a well-known Dallas oilman called Dry Hole Byrd.
I mean, right.
Actually stood for something else, but he had bad luck as an oilman. But he had very good luck with this insider purchase, because it should have been reported, and it wasn't reported because it was an insider purchase.
Uh-huh.
I saw a news story about it in January that the two people had made this purchase, and eventually they did report it. So we know what happened. They invested $2.5 million in LTV, which was a depressed stock at the time because the whole military-industrial complex was on the skids, because you had had the great McNamara purchases, and that was a four-year program, and there were no new contracts. So it was a bad time to buy that stock. Only it turned out, because of the Kennedy assassination and the Vietnam War, to have been a very prescient investment, because the first contract for a Vietnam airplane went in January to LTV, and by my calculation, with $2.5 million in early November 63, by 1965, which when I stopped calculating, was worth $50 million.
Wow!
So it was a 20-ton investment,
and that so it went from $2.5 million to $50 million back then.
By my calculations, it did. Yes, I don't know if they sold or what they did, but yes, by the stock market, that's what happened to that stock. The very first military contract announced in the new Johnson administration was a contract for a fighter plane. I think it was the A-6, and it went in the end of January 1963. It went to LTV. Okay, and now we're talking about similarities. One of the 13 I listed in that book. Excuse me? In this book, I listed it here.
Right, okay.
And I said it could be coincidence, but really. I mean, it doesn't prove there is an assassination. No, it doesn't prove, but come on, you know.
Yeah.
And you have what people are still investigating and learning more and more and more about, which are the investments, selling short of stock in American Airlines and United Airlines before 9/11. Because those airlines was their planes that were shot down, and their stock, could have been predicted, went down.
Right.
When it down, you could sell the puts that you had sold short. You were holding these puts. You sell them, and you sell them at the debased price, and so you recoup what they were worth when you sold them, which was much more.
So they'd have to have foreknowledge of the fact that these stocks were going to plummet.
Well, it could have been just luck, or it could have been foreknowledge. And it turns out it wasn't just the airlines, it was also the reinsurance companies, that they also took a huge hit. And a lot of this selling short was done in Europe, and a lot of the best research now is being done in Europe. And you, Daniel, if you're interested, I can put you in touch with a German scholar.
Please
he's
do.
He's a journalist, but he's also a scholar. He does very good research.
Sounds great.
And he knows far more about this than I did when I wrote this book.
Okay.
The 9/11 Commission said they looked into it and there was nothing into it. Nothing to it. But, I mean, it is so palpably a cover-up that the cover-up suggests to you, hey, why are they covering up? They must be covering up because there's something really there. And I'm persuaded. I'm too old to get into nuts and bolts of things now, but Lars Schaub persuades me, yes, there really is something there. And By the way, a number of other very good journalists are now persuaded there was something there. So, yes, that's one of the similarities. There's 13. Are we going to go through all 13?
I'd love to. Well, one of the fascinating things that I found just intriguing, and we haven't mentioned it here, is that D.H. Byrd actually owned the Texas School Book Depository.
Yes, he owned the School Book Depository.
That tells us a lot. So we have the Patsy Oswalt in that deep event being set up with a job in a building that will be on the motorcade route only 6 weeks before the president visits. His backstory has been well established, making him look like a Russian sympathizer, a classic double identity work. Now, the story of how he got the job was always murky, but there he was on November 22nd, 1963, working there at the Texas School Book Depository. Now, Byrd also helped found the Civil Air Patrol, and Oswalt was in the Civil Air Patrol starting at age 15. Byrd's cousin was Admiral Byrd and the Antarctica explorer. So there's deep military roots there. But Oswalt, at the Texas School Book Depository on that day, and D.H. Byrd owned the building. We really have to stop and think of how important that is.
Well, Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't technically working for the School Book Depository. He was working in the School Book Depository for the School Book Company. He was moving books around. And there's an official explanation how he got the job, but it's not a very persuasive thing to me. I did a manuscript called The Dallas Conspiracy back in the 1970s. And for a while, I was being more quoted. There are many published books that quote my unpublished books.
Right.
And for a while, my hottest item, nobody was interested in my book, The War Conspiracy. Wait just a moment.
All right, take your time.
I have them all, almost. There's only one of my books I don't have. That's a story we won't go into.
Wow, that's the original.
This is the one that came out in 1972. I was going to say that this book was not being cited by anyone, but there were a few brave people who were citing the Dallas Conspiracy. And in the Dallas Conspiracy, there's one whole page. It's nothing but a chart linking people. And in the chart, I have James Ling and D.H. Byrd and the Omega, Alpha Omega, no, is it the corporation, and some other key figures. And they're almost all dead now. I didn't want to publish that book because I was frightened I'd be sued for libel. I circulated to about four people. And one of those people gave it to somebody at the assassination archive. Was it AARC? It was Bud Fensterwald in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
And he put it in the library. And the next thing I knew, somebody was selling it in Montreal. And somebody down in Aptos contacted me and said, well, it's being sold in Montreal. Can I sell it? And I said, well, as long as I have nothing to do with it. So he sold it for years. And now I'm being attacked because I said things in the Dallas Conspiracy that were contradicted by the depolitizing the death of JFK, which was a published book I wrote 25 years later and went a lot more. And then these people who are attacking me say that I published it in Aptos in 19, I never published it at all. Selling it. I had nothing, I had nothing to do selling it.
How do you feel about that unpublished book now? You know, is it worthwhile for somebody to go and dig it up?
Well, I think I tried to take what I thought was most worthwhile and I put it right into Depolitizing.
Okay. So we're not missing anything by not going back to that unpublished book.
You're missing some libelous things.
Well, Professor, this will lead us into one of your big breakthroughs around a major deep event, which you haven't spoken about publicly. And I feel great that we're going to be able to bring this into the record. I think it's an important and major historical discovery. And we will save it for part three because we're out of time now. But Professor, just amazing information. Thank you. Part three will go out for subscribers next week. Make sure you go to darkjournalist.com. Now is the time to subscribe to make sure you don't miss any of the exciting shows we have coming up for you. Professor Scott's paperback edition of The American Deep State, coming up in May, what I think is his greatest book. That'll be available, Barnes & Noble, other booksellers. And Professor, incredible stuff. And let's go into part three.
What I like about you, Daniel, is that you're interested in everything. So that if you just keep narrowly focused, you don't get the idea of what the deep state is.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode with UC Berkeley Professor Peter Dale Scott on the deep state and Cold War II. You can find more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Subscribe to our newsletter at darkjournalist.com to stay updated on the latest shows.